Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic effects. What could be better on a spring day? Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. This is Sonic Effects, and I'm your host for the next little while, Brother Dale Graham, the place where we hope we can address the issues important to the conscience of Freemasons and Freemasonry, the things that may be more challenging to address in a particular lodge. Not to say that that conversation and those ideas shouldn't or needn't be discussed, but using access to the airwaves to allow us to do that together. You found us here. We gather on the 24th of April. It's the 115th day of the year. There's only 251 left. Yep. This year, 2016, is moving along. It's important, I think, to optimize the experience as a Freemason, and one of the things I think we need to realize is that I realize, and I'd like you to challenge, is that we're working very, very hard in Freemasonry to meet a need, of men to come forward with an interest in the Masonic Order. And it occurs to me that, you know, our own performance reveals so much. Our own history reveals so much about our efforts. We didn't design our successes, I don't think. Well, I don't even think if in Freemasonry it's a matter of an organizational success as much as feeding a hunger that's out there in the population of in the minds of good fellows around the world, good people around the world, or, in fact, people with an awareness of goodness that want to or feel the need to improve, to actually understand, improve, not in a competitive way, but through a more essential understanding. It can be said that for a lot of people, organized religions are no longer working. It simply means, I think, that they're no longer answering some of the essential questions in the minds of people, for whatever the reason. I'm not here to knock organized religion. I'm here trying to make an observation, and I think it's essential that we consider the answers for those people may be found in a philosophical dialogue. I think we're not shy of saying that around Masonic effects. That said, it's not as easy as it's not an easy process. It's not something that can be imposed. If somebody is hungry, has a hunger, we can provide them with sustenance. If somebody has an intellectual or emotional hunger, they alone know what they crave. Now, they're not alone. We've been on this earth, as this species, 200 million years? The universe is, can we guess, about 14 billion years old? Yeah, is that close, give or take? So we're in our infancy. We are part of an evolving ecology. We are of the earth. We, as Freemasons, one would think in the contemporary science, would be studying and having those dialogues. Does it matter? You and I that were brought up to being taught for about the past, 200 years, that we aren't part of nature, but we dominate it. Nature's there to do our bidding, that we take what we need from nature, and because it's our imperative. For the first time in the history of humanity, not in the history of the mind, not in the first sense, because if we look at the work of the Greeks, Greek philosophers, we know that these concepts were prevalent 2,500 years ago or more. So we're in that sense, we're rediscovering, but we need to also to be aware that our definition of our place in the universe is now happening. That narrative is occurring. I would ask you simply, what's happening in your Masonic experience regarding that? I'm thinking that we're answering a need that has passed. Needs don't stay the same. Thinking doesn't stay the same. We may have looked up, been lying on our backs and looking up at the stars in the year 200, but that doesn't mean we necessarily had the kind of information about the universe that we do today. Certainly we didn't. We had a sense. Now we have more facts. Did we have a sense then that we were connected globally? Not the shortcomings of human nature, not the pestilence and wars and famine and starvation and the competitiveness, but a connection with everything, with the air, with the earth, with the water. Well, those days where we didn't know have come to an end. Our oceans are not toilets. Our air is not something invisible. It's molecules. We're breathing this soup. And what we put into that matters, because we all will share. We'll all absorb that. So that's something that we can't really ignore anymore. And what we're doing with the earth, well, we have found and used science largely to dominate so we can the natural course of nature, the environment. We can put cities in places where cities shouldn't be. I'm thinking about the desert. We can, take water from one place and grow things in another. Now our scientists and our brightest minds and our futurists are looking at this horizon, and it seems to be coming closer to us. And it's telling us something very clear. We no longer are in a period of asking what we are, who am I? the Delphi. So the questions come to us from the Delphi, the essential question. It seems to be, if we haven't answered that one, it's been eclipsed by another one. What next? It's important then that the thinkers amongst us are able to sort out, how we have done trying to live in the past. Oh, don't get upset with me. I very much enjoy my experience as a Freemason. But when you look around, we wouldn't be challenged as a modern kind of an operation. Oh my goodness, no. That would be almost paradoxical, wouldn't it? Some of the very uncomfortable language that's used, my lady, really? Really? Anyway, all of that stuff is, some of the mannerisms are quaint. Some of them are offensive to the feminist movement. Yes, it does matter. It defines us, and it defines us at the door. So we don't have that opportunity to just wrinkle our little conservative noses and say, oh, that conversation doesn't exist here. Well, you notice the Valparaiso, Pareto's 80-20 rule. Look around. How many of your upstarts, your entered apprentices, attend with any regularity? That rests on the character and nature of a few men, the good mentors who bring a fellow to the order and then connect with him during his inquiries and his study. And they have a parallel experience, one ahead of the other, the mentor in a way, the craftsman teaching the mentor, teaching your student, and not to comply, but to achieve and express a level of individuality or genius if he has that capability. So that breaks down to about an 80-20 rule. So 80%, how many people are lingering? Well, I don't think it's anything that you're doing. I don't think so. I don't think it's the aggression about fundraising. I don't think that. That's unpleasant and uncomfortable, but it's almost tolerable if you don't go to every meeting that you can. And if you stop attending one with any regularity, but just be feral, just be out there attending and happily attending Masonic functions, you can be very successful in avoiding that aggression. You know, that constant, compassion and exhaustion that I've spoken about earlier. Well, that's not stopping just because the idea is brought up. That's continuing on. The apparent misogyny of Freemasonry. Well, we do have to address that in the contemporary environment. If we don't take leadership in that regard, the answers are being filled in for us, which is regrettable and unfortunate and absolutely unnecessary. There is a thoughtful explanation about this question. And yet we are apologists, which hardly seems to connect with a principled ethical order. The concern that I have is, and I think that we share, is that the need that we're driving forward is to keep things at a static moment in time that's passed. We know when our membership really climbed, as if quantity is a measure of quality. And it certainly isn't. Even the most conservative amongst us would have to recognize that fact. Although he may have his own a right to his own opinion, he does not have a right to his own facts. That's the nature of the world we live in. That's common law, common good. That time has passed, and yet we're continuing to do what was going on at that time, as if those men are still coming in off the foreign shores and coming back to repatriate after serving their country. Well, times have changed. We still have men and women coming back from service to our country. The nature of conflict around the world is very high. But they're coming back to a 21st century environment, a world that's moving not to the 20th or 19th or 18th, but to moving toward the 22nd and 23rd centuries. We don't stop. How have we done with that? Stopping in time. How's it been going for you and your lodge? Even then, that said, if we are trying to create a reenactment of 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century Europe, how are we doing with that? How many people around your lodge have any sense of the Renaissance or the period of enlightenment or the arts or sciences? The arts, you know, it's how vital is that? How much is that a part of the discourse at meetings? I'd suggest I'm not here to embarrass. I would suggest that fits in with the 80-20 rule. Why it's probably a small number of scholars amongst us or people that are tuned or curious that have been perhaps natural students, people that with or without the order would have been inclined to observe and study. And keeping up with the current science and evolution of the arts doesn't mean that we abandon the historical references. Far from it. This isn't an either or. Brethren, we live in a world that has moved forward with or without us. We create an illusion in our minds about stability and success. I'm thinking not that we are an alien force. We're part of an evolution. And it's not up to any one person or grand lodges to stop time, to stop progress, because that's just not feasible, is it? And for us to be having questions about whether we actually like it or not seems to be really a far-flung paradox. It's quite inconsistent with the ritual of Freemasonry after a careful reading. So I'm thinking, and I guess I put it as a question, why do we make it so difficult? Why do we make it so hard to address what's right in front of us, to acknowledge rights for what's right in front of us? Why are we clinging with such a desperation to something that is a thought, a passing thought? History exists in our minds, yeah? Even our own history. Have we stifled creativity and innovation in Freemasonry? And is it time to stop? Or, as with most things, do we not give up this old paradigm until it is exhausted and broken? I'm thinking that we're moving that way. And it will not be complete. It will not have perfectly squared corners. It will be an incomplete process of decline until regrowth occurs, if you're looking for a nice and I think a logical metaphor. that change, that evolution is upon us. What season is, in your mind, what season are we in? For me, I think the seasons come and seasons go. I think seasons come and seasons go. I could be wrong. I'm going to have a commentary for you when we come back. Here. Speaking of seasons. This is something from Wales. Can you not like Vivaldi? He's an odd little fellow, priest. And this was the idea of writing a symphony around the theme of four seasons wasn't exactly original. It had been done earlier by an Italian, so another Italian. But who's going to throw mud on it? This is amazing, you know? Maybe someday I'll play some of the original. The Four Seasons by the, you know, not the original, but by the composer that developed the idea in the first place. But I digress here. We're celebrating, aren't we? The 23rd of April. The boy who's we're celebrating his 450th birthday today, William Shakespeare. Widely regarded as the greatest writer in the English language and the world's preeminent dramatist. But being boys, we need to hear some of how he made insults so beautiful. When I am sick, when I do look at thee, really? Oh, you know, all right, it's the Baird. Villain, I have done thy mother. Thou elfish marked abortive rooting hog. Boy, that's a little bit harsh. Away, you starveling, you elf skin, you dried meats, tongue bulls, pizzle, you stockfish. Well, don't hold back here, Bill. Say what you... Thou art a boil, a plague sore. That's a little harsh, don't you think, Bill? Would thou wert clean enough to spit on? Would thou wert burst the rankest compound of villainous smell that ever offended a nostril. Away, you three-inch fool. Ugh, I scorn you, scurvy companion. Thou sodden-witted lord, thou hast no more brain than I have in mine elbows. I'll beat thee, but it would infect my hands. Well, never one for holding back, I guess. There you have it, eh? William Shakespeare. Love looks not with the eyes, but with the mind. And therefore is winged Cupid painted blind. To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. Love all, trust a few, do wrong to none. Happy birthday, Mr. Shakespeare. The comment today about the challenging path to enlightenment, I think it is. Yes, we seek the light, but I think it's a difficult path. And the challenging path of enlightenment is really about discovering your question. To what end do we live? To live well? To be accepted? To conquer life? To be superior? To rule? Doubtful. Anyone born had a malevolent purpose to his life at birth. How is it the inner voice offers solace and protection when it is heard? Is it mistrust of our own thoughts that is the catalyst for fearing common sense? Freemasonry is a commonality given birth by our collective common sense. The Masonic classroom is where chaos reigns at the door, where the timid student lingers closest to the door, and cynics shine their shoes to a brilliant sheen and practice the acquired art of the secret disdaining eye roll. It is where old men fear falling more than living an empty life. And where young men rashly clamor about for the task that will absolve them of questions, stay busy. You don't have to probe. You don't have to know why and what. Just stay busy. In the lodge classroom is where the hopeful search for connections. It is a place, is it a place of learning? Does it meet expectations? Who is the philosopher? Who the leader? Teaching someone the expectations of an entered apprentice. Somebody can come wanting to be an entered apprentice, but we have to teach them what's expected of them. Teaching that confirms respect for his thoughtful and genius. Confidence in his ability to learn. When we're working with the apprentice, we're identifying the potential for genius, for brilliance within him. His potential to be inspired by greatness, not ours to impose an artificial sense of accomplishment. My goodness, are we saying that accomplishments in the marketplace is what we mean? Where did that leak into the conversation? It's not the place for parroting ideas, but a place for learners to be with their peers, to study spirituality using references, some that have endured from 5th century BC, blending with contemporary thought. What serious-minded questions are on his mind? How does he find answers? Where does he look? Are poetry and music being introduced as aspects that help mankind understand the emotion of being? There's always a time and a place for dialogue within the mind. Of course.
Thank you. like the gentle rain. Come, little world, you have me. Our love will be sweet, very sad, very sweet, like the gentle rain, like the gentle rain, like the gentle rain.
Oh, Diana Krall, yeah. Diana Krall, Miss Krall. Here, don't believe me when I'm talking about like this. This is radical. Found your comfortable seat, I hope. And just because I'm concerned about you being dehydrated, I think you should always strive to have a mug of your comfort in hand. If you're fortunate enough to be able to enjoy a glass of ale or a whiskey, this might be a nice time to enjoy it. If you're wise enough to do it, live in moderation, you may be enjoying a glass of water. Just to make sure you can sip. A lot has been said about masonry over the years. Some of it is particularly odd, but a lot of it is speculation. So I don't expect that, even from within the organizations. I think it's reasonable to say this idea of progress is really quite uncomfortable and will be met with a typically muscular reaction that we would expect when we're dealing with a large but shrinking group of men. And all of that aside, it doesn't change the idea, the merit of the ideas that we're talking about here. I would hope that you will think that philosophy will have be the answer. I don't expect you to embrace that because somebody the likes of me says that. I want you to listen to a little piece. This is, if you have access to the internet, check out these something under the School of Life. And there's a whole list of discourses on some of the essential philosophers through time. This is a little 8-minute slip on Immanuel Kant. Now, I think Immanuel Kant, he's a German philosopher, around 1727, I think. So if you think about that, the ethos, if we're still talking about the start of organizational governance, it was, we're coming up to what the 300th anniversary of that 1717, that infamous date in history for us. This guy was writing, he was alive around that time. They became acutely aware of living in an age when philosophy would need to supplant the role once played by religion. When I was thinking about rethinking Kant, this is somebody that I didn't read I was in university, but discovered. Like Soren Kierkegaard or Plato, you get some of that if you're exposed to liberal education. Schopenhauer, you discover, I think. Hegel, for me, it was part of my education. Camus was just, I had to read that. Anyway, I'm just not giving you the opportunity here to listen to this. This is a piece, a spoken piece, on Immanuel Kant. And as you sit back, I want you to listen for the so-called Masonic ideas in this, the ideas that Masonry has drawn from the mind of this philosopher. I think this is imperative, but let me know. I'll be here when this is done.
Immanuel Kant is a philosopher who tried to work out how human beings could be good and kind outside of the exhortations and blandishments of traditional religions. He was born in 1724 in the Baltic city of Königsberg, which at that time was part of Prussia and now belongs to Russia, renamed Kaliningrad. Kant's parents were very modest. His father was a saddle maker. Kant never had much money, a fact he dealt with cheerfully by living very modestly. It wasn't until he was in his 50s that he became a fully salaried professor and attained a moderate degree of prosperity. His family were deeply religious and very strict. Later in life, Kant did not have any conventional religious beliefs, but he was acutely aware of just how much religion had contributed to his parents' ability to cope with all the hardships of their existence, and how useful religion could be in fostering social cohesion and community. Kant was physically very slight, frail, and anything but good-looking, yet he was very sociable, and some of his colleagues used to criticize him for going to too many parties. When eventually he was able to entertain, he had rules about conversation at his table. At the start of a dinner party, he decreed that people should swap stories about what had been happening recently. Then there should be a major phase of reflective discourse, in which those present attempted to clarify an important topic. And finally, there should be a closing period of hilarity, so that everyone left in a good mood. He died in 1804, in his 80th year in Königsberg, having rarely felt the need to spend any time outside the city in which he was born. Kant was writing at a highly interesting period in history we now know as the Enlightenment. In an essay called What is Enlightenment, published in 1784, Kant proposed that the identifying feature of his age was its growing secularism. Intellectually, Kant welcomed the declining belief in Christianity, but in a practical sense, he was also alarmed by it. He was a pessimist about human character and believed that we are by nature intensely prone to corruption. It was this awareness that led him to formulate what would be his life's project, the desire to replace religious authority with the authority of reason, that is, human intelligence. When it came to religion, Kant summed up his views in a book entitled Religion Within the Bounds of Reason Alone. Here he argued that although historical religions had all been wrong in the content of what they believed, they had latched onto a great need to promote ethical behavior, a need which still remained. It was in this context that Kant came up with the idea for which he is perhaps still most famous, what he called the categorical imperative. This strange-sounding term first appeared in a horrendously named work, Groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals. The categorical imperative states, act only according to that maxim by which you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. What did Kant mean by this? This was only a very formal restatement of an idea that's been around for a long time, something we meet with in all the main religions. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Kant was offering a handy way of testing the morality of an action by imagining how it would be if it were generally practiced and you were the victim of it. It might be tempting to filch a few pads of paper from the stationery cupboard at work. It seems like a small thing, but if everyone did this, the cupboard and society at large would need a lot of guards. Similarly, if you have an affair and keep it quiet from your partner, you might feel that's okay, but the categorical imperative comes down against this, because you would then have to embrace the idea that it would be equally okay for your partner to have affairs and not tell you. The categorical imperative is designed to shift our perspective, to get us to see our own behavior in less immediately personal terms, and thereby recognize some of its limitations. Kant went on to argue that the core idea of the categorical imperative could be stated in another way. Act so as to treat people always as ends in themselves, never as mere means. This was intended as a replacement for the Christian injunction for universal love, the command to love one's neighbor. To treat a person as an end For Kant meant keeping in view that they had a life of their own, in which they were seeking happiness and fulfillment and deserved justice and fair treatment. The categorical imperative, Kant argued, is the voice of our own rational selves. It's what we all truly believe when we're thinking sensibly. It's the rule our own intelligence gives us. Kant extended his thinking about the categorical imperative into the political sphere. He believed that the central duty of government is to ensure liberty. But he sensed that there was something terribly wrong with the ordinary definition of freedom or liberty. It should not be thought of in libertarian terms as the ability to do just whatever we want. We are free only when we act in accordance with our own best natures, and we are slaves whenever we are under the rule of our own passions or those of others. As Kant put it, a free will and a will under moral laws are one and the same. So freedom isn't an absence of government. A free society isn't one that allows people more and more opportunity to do whatever they happen to fancy. It's one that helps everyone become more reasonable. The good state represents the rational element in us all. It rules according to a universally valid will under which everyone can be free. So government, ideally, is the externalized, institutionalized version of the best parts of ourselves. It might be a bit surprising at first to discover that in 1793, Kant published a major work on beauty and art, The Critique of Judgment. It might seem like a bit of a sideline for a thinker otherwise concerned with politics and ethics, but Kant held that his ideas about art and beauty were the cornerstones of his entire philosophy. As we've been seeing, Kant thought that life involved a constant struggle between our better selves and our passions, between duty and pleasure. Beauty, Kant especially liked roses, vines, apple trees, and birds, delights us in a very special and important way. It's a reminder of and goad to our better selves. Unlike so much else in our lives, our love of beauty is, in Kant's word, disinterested. It takes us out of our narrow, selfish concerns, but in a charming, delightful way, without being stern or demanding. The beauty of nature is a continual, quiet, and insistent reminder of our common universal being. A pretty flower is just as attractive to the tired farm worker as to the prince. The graceful flight of a swallow is as lovely to a child as to the most learned professor. For Kant, the role of art is to embody the most important ethical ideas. It's a natural extension of philosophy. Kant held that we needed to have art continually before us so as to benefit from vivid illustrations and memorable symbols of good behavior, and thereby keep the wayward parts of ourselves in check. Kant's books were dense, abstract, and highly intellectual, but in them he sketched a very important project that remains crucial to this day. He wanted to understand how the better, more reasonable parts of our natures could be strengthened so as to reliably win out over our inbuilt weaknesses and selfishness. As Kant saw it, he was engaged in the task of developing a secular, rational version of what religions had, very imperfectly, always attempted to do: help us to be good.
Didn't know that. Didn't know all of that. The categorical imperative seems to be one of the pillars of Freemasonry. If you tend to go down that tunnel, how many ideas germane to Freemasonry and to the development of the mind came out of that, came to you from that short discourse on Mr. Kant, particularly the idea of art? I rarely have thought about it in rational terms. For me, and I think a lot of people, it's an emotional experience. What, at least when I'm talking with friends who are artists, they're always talking to me, they often will talk to me about attempting an emotional reaction, and quite delighted when that occurs. Some a particular type of reaction, others a reaction period. So for him to say that what that does to keep these images in front of us, and the benefit of keeping such images in front of us, suggests that an opportunity, simply an opportunity, whether we take it or not, that to me
is less important, I think, right now. Things happen slowly and gradually, and we're complicated. But I think the discussion has already started. It was started a long time ago, hundreds of years ago in the Masonic Order. And it's been lying in front of us, buried, hidden in broad daylight, hidden in the light, to be discovered. And I think this is an answer. This way of thinking and approaching life and Freemasonry certainly is an answer that a lot of our members have been looking for, and that young men today, young people, are searching for. I think eventually we will no longer be a male-female defined organization, I think. But that's in an intellectually progressive sense as we progress through time. How long that takes, I can't see. But inevitably, it's there to happen, simply because we can't escape our own philosophy. We can't escape the embrace, the grip that we have on an ethical principle life, and we can't escape our rational being. So, those are things we can't escape. It's kind of ridiculous to even think about it. So vulnerable is Freemasonry, I think. Back around between 1997 and 1998 in Britain, there was a parliamentary committee investigating Freemasonry in the judiciary. They wanted to know if Freemasonry were pulling strings in the courts. And there was an MP that was tasked with providing opinion. His name was Chris Mullen. And it's really revealing. It's a bit painful in a way. When he was asked for his main source of information on the subject of Freemasonry, he admitted that it was a book called Inside the Brotherhood. In fact, that book is quite hostile to the craft. People are entitled to hold such beliefs as they may, so long as they mean no harm to other people, and similarly respect the like entitlement in others. So, you know, we can agree to disagree, Mr. Mullen. But then we have the evidence, you know? There have been ecclesiastical attacks on Freemasonry. And at least in the past, the United Grand Lodge of England has addressed those attacks. I don't know if it's fair to get into that right now. We're coming to the end of the program. We need to talk about the Roman Catholic Church and from the time of Pope Clement the 12th, when he issued the first bull against Freemasonry. And that appeared on the 28th of April. It's coming up, 1738. Just at a time when Freemasonry had arrived in Italy. And the Jacobite Freemasons were being spied upon by the British government in Florence and elsewhere. But at that time, the Vatican ruled a substantial portion of Italy as a state. And its interests were not entirely theological. In this bull, Masonry was attacked because Masons were men of every religion, because Masons manifested in men of upright morals, because Masons made oaths to support one another, because oaths were made on the Bible and advocated punishment for the breakers of oaths contrary to law. And because Freemasonry has been banned in other states as being contrary to the state's welfare because of other just and reasonable motives known to us. The Pope was that us. The main motive behind the bulls seemed to have been a political one. The Pope simply did not want what appeared to be a new sect involving Catholics, active and secretly influencing politics outside of his knowledge. The theological reasons were and are related to the status of the Catholic Church as it perceives itself to be. The Roman Catholic Church, regarding itself as the sole path to salvation, will not tolerate being put on a par with other religions, or accepting that its absolute claims may be made relative claims in the interest of tolerance. As Sir Stephen Runciman has said, tolerance is a social, not a religious virtue, hence wars of religion. But can we come back? That's just a sample. There's been a war going on over our sense of rational thought, over rational thought itself. You and I have a reference to ritual that speaks about superstition, doesn't it? Well, it's not that superstition, the influence of superstition is the discussion or a secret that from the world, it's out there. And it's important that we understand when that's being applied and the effects. Apart from our rational being is the importance of religion in our lives, as Kant outlined. I think in another period we'll play a piece on René Descartes. And you can begin for yourself to begin to see how these ideas fit together. It's coming close to the time when we have to go. I'll leave you with a little bit of a toe tapper from a period that I really enjoy. It's a song by Fred Astaire. I hope you'll continue to commit acts of random Masonic kindness wherever you go, and to be an influence and a man who was spoken about in his community behind his back as an honorable fellow, a good man, a decent guy, a caring individual, of curious personal habits, of unique tastes, a man with either can quote a favorite piece of poetry or can have a favorite poem, who has an eye for the arts and a preference for perhaps one over the other. And his library and readings demonstrate the kind of thinker that he is. The great architect is watching over us all. And as Masonic Effects progresses, I think that we are attempting and we're doing a reasonable job of demonstrating what the deists know. We don't have to rely on the supernatural events to show evidence of a creator. It's around us in everything we do. We're going to talk to you more in the future about Freemasonry and the environmental presence, our responsibility to the planet. It's one of those things we need to look at, and because our younger members and people coming into the order certainly are. Anyway, enjoy this little tune, and I look forward to having you join me next week. In the meantime, bye.
Someday, when I'm awfully low and the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight. Oh, but you're lovely with your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft, There is nothing for me but to love you, just the way you look. You love me. With each word your tenderness grows, tearing my fear apart. And that mouth that wrinkles your nose touches my foolish heart. Love will never, never change. Keep that breathless charm. Won't you please arrange it, 'cause I love you just the way you.